Welcome to Drinks Insider, the podcast that's interested in everything you can drink. If it's legal, if you can sell it, and more importantly, if you can make money from it, then we're going to talk about it. So come on this journey into the commercial world of everything drinkable. I'm your host, Felicity Carter, and you're listening to Drinks Insider. Did you know that you can get a huge sales bump just by sending an email? I just looked up the stats on how effective email marketing is, and some researchers are reporting that you can earn $42 for every $1 you spend. While I think that's pretty optimistic, I can see for myself through my Drinks Insider newsletter that it's possible to build an audience pretty fast. But don't believe me. The person to speak to is Jonathan Reeve, co-founder of BevSuite, and he's an expert in the intersection of wine, data and technology. He's previously worked for Treasury Wine Estates, Wine Search in New Zealand, and the Fine Wine Exchange LiveX in London. All of this has made him an expert in wine data and how to use it effectively. And according to him, there are still plenty of ways to increase wine profitability. In this episode, he explains how it all works. If you would like to know more, sign up for the Drinks Insider newsletter at drinksinsider.com. And if you have any suggestions or feedback, drop me a line at Felicity at drinksinsider.com. Jonathan, great to see you again.
Indeed, good to see you too.
Okay, let's get straight into it. Can you explain what BevSuite is?
Yes, so BevSuite at the moment is a very early stage startup. We're a services company aimed specifically, as the name implies, at the beverage alcohol industry. The long-term goal is to build a suite of interconnected, that's the important bit, interconnected products and services that will help make beverage alcohol retailers' lives easy. That's the long-term goal. But really, with the stage we're at today is listening, learning, and building our network, our knowledge, our skills, and our team. So that's kind of where we are now. We're going to talk a little bit, I guess, later on about the specific products we are doing that with, but that's roughly in a nutshell, early stage startup.
Right. So if I could just paraphrase that, you're going to revolutionize the beverage industry at some point.
Everybody said that and we're going to do it. Yep.
You're going to do it. Okay. That's why I'm interested in talking to you today. All right. Let's backtrack and talk about your career. You've worked everywhere. You've worked in Australia with Treasury. You've worked in New Zealand. You worked in the UK. Start with, I think, one of the most interesting companies, which you worked with, Wine Searcher. How did you come to work there and what did you do for them?
Possibly, I was just thinking about, you know, obviously I knew we were going to talk about this, and I thought about my past. And the moment I think about Wine Searcher most is I was actually working for a retailer. I've been doing it for about 6 months and was just getting sort of a little bit itchy, thinking I wanted something bigger. And I just happened to learn about this company called Wine Searcher, who I honestly had never heard of at that point. This is 2008, and they were looking for somebody with linguistic skills with a database type brain who knew about wine.
And honestly, okay, that is an interesting combination of requirements.
Right. And if anybody had interviewed me or talked to me the day before, they would have said, okay, well, perfect job for you is that. And literally this just cropped up. Even weirder, they were within walking distance of my house.
Okay, so this is kismet right there. What were you doing in New Zealand?
So I followed a girlfriend out there, actually. I went traveling around the world for 18 months and worked in Chile, as you said, New Zealand, Australia, briefly in South Africa, and then ended up falling in love and moving back to New Zealand with a Kiwi. And that was that, really. I became an Aucklander, and that's where Wine Search is based.
Did you stick with the girlfriend?
She became my wife, yes.
Oh, okay, you did. Okay, so it really was kismet. Okay, so let's talk about Wine Searcher. There's this weirdo job description, linguist, database, you know, knows about wine. So what was the job?
Well, the job, I mean, they were, weirdly enough, they were actually kind of like, actually quite similar to where BevSuite is now, that they're working out exactly how to scale the business. Martin had been running the business for, I think, 10 years by that point, but only on a relatively small scale. It was quite high impact given how shoestring it all was, but actually he really wanted to ramp up the business into what we now know. So he began gathering a collection of people together. The goals at the time were become big, as in become visible. So we'll come to how we did that later on. Build a database of the wines of the world, which it all sounds very almost cliche now because so many people have tried to do this, build this comprehensive database. But at the time, there really wasn't one. And even today, Wine Cellar, I still believe, is the biggest.
Well, the funny thing was, you know, in 2008, I interviewed Martin Brown for Miningers, and I didn't understand what they did. It was like a search engine about wine, and I was like,
yeah, and yeah. I think that's probably because it was relatively new as a concept at the time. No one was really clear on whether it was owning the trade of the transaction, whether it was a pure marketing platform, whether it was a content platform. And honestly, this is kind of what I'm driving at, that we didn't really truly know what we were going to be. And it was formed mostly by the collection of people that were gathered there. So I have very, very fond memories of that time when we had in the room together, we had ex-winemakers who just come from Margaux, and we have had very successful people who've gone on to do strong winemaking careers, or digital strategists. They're from everywhere around the world. So you basically ended up with the company being built around the skills that the people had. It had an idea of what it wanted to be, but you ended up with me writing the encyclopedic stuff, and you had a very organized team of data heads all building the database. And then from there, it just evolved very naturally around the people that stuck around.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I've been at the ground floor of a number of magazines and digital products, and somebody will always write this really tight business case, and they'll work out the personas of the audience and whatever. And then you start the thing and it bears no relationship to what you planned. You know, you just, things grow in their own direction. Okay, so in those early days, what was Wine Search's mission? What was it you were there to achieve?
So building the wine database of the world in order to supply marketing or advertising, really, services for wine retailers around the world. So by building up lots and lots and lots of lists of all the wine merchants around the world, those wine merchants would get referrals because Wine Search was hoovering up all the traffic. It was this kind of black hole of wine interested traffic. Everything would come through Wine Searcher as a kind of a funnel, a spider site, however you want to look at it. And then the referrals would be sent back to the wine retailers, who would be ever so grateful that they were getting all this business from Wine Searcher. And then Wine Searcher would monetize that by saying, okay, well, we can make that more interesting for you by doubling the amount of traffic you're getting if you pay us, you know, a certain fee. So that's what Wine Searcher calls sponsors.
So you're sitting in Auckland writing up about the world. Where did you get your data from?
So a mixture of things. And I'm glad that this kind of came up, because it's really, again, a nostalgic thing, because when you think about where you get your information from now, there's so much information everywhere. And I even asked ChatGPT recently where it got its seed data about wine from, because I know full well that something that I wrote will be in there. It's not allowed to tell you officially, so it doesn't. Back then, we had things like Google Earth. Google Earth was a huge resource, and I basically spent 4 years flying around the world virtually on one of my big three screens on my desk, because you can fly into the world. You know, they had all kinds of data taken from satellites. You can see altitudes and elevation, and you can see rock color. I'm not kidding. You can actually see soil color in a lot of places like Coonawarra. And the southeast of France, there's quite a lot of terra rossa soils down there. You can see that from the imagery. And you can also, there's a little slider where you can, I don't know if it's still there, you could change the time of day that you were viewing this at. So you could fly in 3D, look at a hillside like Corton, for example, and you could say, okay, well, in the morning, the sun's obviously hitting it, you know, from the east, therefore the slopes are getting gradually lighter as you move the slider. And by about kind of 5 p.m. in the middle of summer, it's beginning to get a bit shady. And you can read so much into that if you've got the basic understanding of what that means.
Were you already knowledgeable about geography, or did you have to learn about that as you were doing this?
Ish. So I learned a lot by traveling the first 18 months of my world tour of you know, working in the wine world. I worked at Erasuris and Villa Maria, Voyager Estate, and that was just very much hands-on geekery. But I'd read Janssens Robinson's Wine Course, was the first book I ever read, and she sort of became a hero from there. And I just got very, very, very interested. I hadn't done my diploma by then. I think I'd done level 3 WSET, but that was kind of it. So I was living, breathing, and surrounded by everything wine for that time. So it just all slotted in. And if there was something I didn't know or I couldn't quite work out, I had behind me this bank of wine experts from around the world, all of whom kind of wanted my job because I had the cool job. And they just wanted to help. So they would dive in and say, yeah, well, this happens because that happens. And it just really helped put together that data.
What's your favorite geology?
Oh, do you know what? This is actually where I want to be buried if I get a choice. There's a little Yeah, honestly, it's called the, if you've ever been to, actually, you probably have, Domaine de Bedon. So it's in the Swiss Valley, and there's an overhanging cliff on the mountains that face the Alps that face south. And there's the river running alongside, it's the Rhone. And that particular geography, I was watching some videos of when I went there last time. And it's just, it just makes me, kind of gives me little chills of how amazing that geography is. It's little terraces that have been worked for, I guess, 1,000 years, monasteries on top of hills and little ridges of golden vines if you go there in sort of October time. And then these towering great mountains straight above with snow. It's, I love that. It's such a great place to...
Now, you've actually been there, not just seen it on Google Earth.
No, I actually went there. So I went to visit Jacques and Marion Grange. They own a place, a little winery you can only get to by cable car. That's how they do their vintage. Or they made me walk up for about 45 minutes up their little sentier, up their little track, which is really, really steep. And I had just the time of my life visiting them, trying their homemade cheeses and herbs. And I should tell you a story about the apple. I'll keep it brief. But they gave me a few apples from their orchard, biodynamic, organic. And I took the apples back down the cable car with me. Had a great night with the wine conference back then? The DWCC?
Oh, the digital, the Wine Bloggers Conference.
Yeah, and this was back then when it was in Montreux.
Oh, and I went to that. We probably passed in the night.
Away from each other, yeah. And so I took that back and we all, you know, you remember there were
2014.
Yes, exactly, yeah, November. And we all went out and obviously there were lots of evenings out. Completely forgot about these apples, and you'll know how strict New Zealand is about biosecurity. Mm. So when I get picked up by the wife at midnight in Auckland, she's wondering where I am. Where I actually am is having a beagle has bitten its way into my bag. And I'm thinking, what the hell's happened here? What is going on? Have I got drugs on me that I don't know about? And the dog is going crazy. And it's because of this apple that Jacques and Marion Grange gave me. $500 fee later, I eventually got released to the wife. But
yes, for listeners who haven't been to New Zealand, both Australia and New Zealand take quarantine very, very seriously because they're islands and they've been free of many diseases. So when you land at Auckland Airport or any of the international airports, there are multiple signs that say, here's a bin where you can drop any fruit you're carrying. And then you walk a couple more minutes, it goes, did you see the bin? You can put your, and then you keep walking and eventually it says, if you are carrying anything, you are going to be fined and your sorry ass is going to go to jail. So you obviously forgot. Okay. Okay, let's go back to wine searches.
Yeah,
so what of this encyclopedic knowledge that you were putting there? What was the point of it?
So Google fodder, to put it very bluntly. So at the time, of course, Google, this is, 2008 to 2012-ish, Google was very much everyone's fascination, working out how it worked, seeing if they could hack the algo. And the basic obvious things were, one, Wikipedia did really well. So what was Wikipedia? It was a huge educational resource that had logical links between concepts and references, that kind of thing. So it was hugely trusted. And I was basically instructed, go and build the Wikipedia of wine. Believe it or not, we were given about 40 minutes to do per appellation, and we ended up doing about 4,000. So the 40-minute thing had to go out the window. 4,000 pages in total. I'll explain more if we want to later about what the breakdown of that was. But the aim was really to make sure that Google sent people to Wine Searcher whenever they typed in something like Romani Conti wine or
search engine optimization,
wine,
basically.
Wherever it was. Yeah.
Mm. Okay. So you did that and you became the world's expert in soils and slopes. And then you ended up at Livex in London. What were you doing there?
So Livex was an interesting change, I guess, for me. I moved back from New Zealand in late 2017 and spent a year with wine owners, helping them build their business. And they've obviously gone very, very successfully on to work on the hub. And at the time, I was sure that my skills needed to be elsewhere at the time. They didn't actually have the hub back then, and I wanted to do more at that time. So I went and introduced myself to James Miles, and he said to me, if you could do anything right now, if you could change any one thing about the wine world, what would it be? And I loved the way he was thinking and talking and opening up that world. And my response, it remains sadly the same today. It would be stop moving my wine around. If you've got it in bonds, stop shifting it around between warehouses. Every time I sell it, buy it, move it, and get everything interconnected. Get the data flowing neatly. So within a very short space of time, ultimately, they'd offer me a job and I moved there.
Okay, I'm just going to interject and say, for anyone who doesn't know, LiveX is the fine wine trading platform done in London. You can only join if you're a merchant, and basically merchants offer each other their wines. So if a merchant in Germany has a customer who needs some Barolo, they go on LiveX and they can see that somebody in Hong Kong has it and they trade with them. You can't join it as a collector and you can't join it as a private individual. So it's basically the center. It's become the center of the fine wine world. Now, how did you move data around the company? How did you change the flow?
Gotcha. So LiveX's main thing it's famous for is its wine data. But actually, what I was moving around was the other side of the data, the business data, its own data. So about LiveX itself as an operational entity, how was it doing as a business, and how did people join it, and how many customers did it have, and that kind of stuff. So there were three key things really that we changed. And the first thing, I still can't quite believe it when I think about this, but this was 2019 by that point. And the application form to join this very technologically advanced business was a Word document with a table in it and all rather cramped because it had been added to over the years and compressed into a single page of A4. And I kid you not, we used to email it to a customer or a prospect who would then have to fill it in pen, or maybe they had the advanced knowledge of how to print it out digitally, and then post it or fax it to us. This included a signature and bank details. So this was just so antediluvian compared to...
No. I worked for a German publishing house and you had to do exactly that. And if you wanted to subscribe, you had to print off the form, you had to fill it in, you had to fax it in, and only then did you ring up and give your credit card details over the phone. I mean, it's just, you know...
It's incredible how many businesses are still like this. And that's part of the reason we're talking today, I guess, because it's very, very topical. And so we looked at the rest of the business, which is very much more advanced than that. And we just went, this is kind of not okay. Customers are arriving to us going, okay, so you're LiveX, you're the famous people who have these graphs all around the internet. You're the thing that people make their purchasing decisions on. And this is how I'm applying. I'm about to give you X thousand pounds. It felt
just to comment on that. I think what happens with businesses and even with really small wine businesses is things just proliferate. So I did a job back in Australia years ago for banks. So banks have thousands and thousands of what they call touch points, right? So you sign up for a bank account, you change this, you change that. And every time this happens, the bank is obliged by law to send you a letter. So one customer can generate, you know, 150 or 1,500 different types of letters. And over the years, the banks had just accumulated more and more and more and more and more of these form letters. And so it was a big job. And when financial law changed, they needed to change every single one of these emails and to actually go in and just rationalize them all. And you realize that they had built up a whole stock of stuff they didn't need to send anybody. And that's just the nature of business. Somebody has to come in and prune it all. So what have you learned about data and the wine business from all of this?
Disconnectedness is still, even today, the number one thing. And I'm not kidding. Earlier on, yesterday morning, I got a wine delivery. I had sent my address to the retailer in this model, and they had then passed on my delivery address to the logistics provider, and you could tell that hadn't been done digitally because the number changed from a 12 to a 13. And the only reason I got the delivery of 9 cases of wine was because I happened to overhear a van door closing and went to look. So that tells you that even today, even with quite an expensive consignment of wine, there is a human somewhere interjected into the process who's holding the two cables together from the various companies that are involved. So what I've really, really seen is that, sure, the data is getting more. There are, you know, LiveX has built Elwyn, which is a great resource for standardizing how you identify wines, which is great. WineSearch has built a huge database of pricing, also with names of appellations and wine, great varieties connected to that. But ultimately, these are lovely, great resources that actually still now are not being connected where they need to be connected.
I think I need to go back a step and say, 9 cases of wine, what were you buying?
Well, it's a long story. You know what's going to happen here on the 1st of Feb, right?
Oh, the wine duty. Yeah. Duty changes in the UK, yes.
And I guess I won't be giving away too much. It's probably obvious. But well, one thing that may not be obvious, Liebex is very kind to its staff, and it also has a great chunk of the LCB warehouse carved out for helping Liebex do its logistics. LCB. So I was removing some cases of wine that Liebex had kindly been storing for me even after I had left. Oh, and gosh. that was a chunk of those.
What's the LCB warehouse?
LCB Warehouse, that's London City Bond, which is a very, very big storage provider. It's a government-controlled warehouse where a vast amount of wine arrives every day into the physical Britain that doesn't actually go through customs until it leaves that warehouse.
Right, let's go back to the ever-interesting topic of money. Having worked with data and so on, what did you learn about how you price things?
Gotcha. Difficult. And that is why it's so profitable to do it correctly and such a missed opportunity if you don't, because data has no price tag attached to it. The cost of generating it can be really hard to estimate, because a cost plus model when you're building data is just, it ends up in arguments over truly what you spent building a data point. Really, the way you need to sell data is a value-based selling. So what value is this data point and this system of data points adding to the life and the business of the person you're selling it to? That is the fundamental flip in the way that we all have to think. It's kind of like, I guess it's probably an unpopular topic, but the way that Burgundy is currently becoming more and more expensive, it's supply and demand. It's not actually a cost plus model. So you have to learn, when you're a SaaS business or a data business, you have to learn what your customers are willing to pay for the thing you're building. And it's only a relatively recent part of our lives, of our world, you know, 20 years really as a big part of the wine world. And the ignorance that most companies, well, the information they don't have is how you actually price that. So what we did at Liebex, that was part of my job for a few years, was establishing what a customer is truly willing to pay for this very valuable service.
This is all of the people like me, who's consultants and freelancers on the call, going, how do you work out how to price things? Because this is the eternal question, because you have information asymmetry. I don't know what somebody is prepared to pay. How do you work it out?
Lots of talking, loads and loads of talking, and also just really, and listening. I mean, you know, by talking, the listening is implied there. So talking to customers, working out what they actually do with your data, and then extrapolating from there what downstream operations they must be doing with that information. And of course, you can roughly estimate what kind of turnover they've got. You can roughly work out the margins, and you kind of build a model for the impact of your data in their world. You don't just instantly then slap a price on it. You have to then go through negotiation. And I think the second thing that I learned, that we learned as a business at Liebex, about pricing, was get your whole company on board behind it. Because if you suddenly just increase your price and you haven't explained why, then your sales team have the same problem as if they don't have faith in the product. Now, the product was great at Liebex and the data was great at Liebex, and we put the price up. And one mistake that I made early on was actually not explaining to everybody inside the business why we're doing this and why they should be confident in the price we're charging. Is that roughly answering the question?
Yeah, it's very interesting. My a member of my family, a young guy, works in a shop selling chocolates, and they've recently put the price, they offered these great deals and they've slashed the deals, and they are now offering customers a much poorer experience. And so James wants to walk out because he thinks they're ripping off. What he hasn't been told is that the price of cocoa has gone up enormously.
Right.
And maybe if somebody had explained that to him, he wouldn't be so indignant.
Completely. And I completely agree. We have to factor these things in, communicating to your staff and your customers why you need to do this thing. One of our big problems in 2022, wasn't it? Ukraine and the petrol shortages. And we had to suddenly put our prices up again to cover the logistics element of the service. You can't just do it. You have to explain, this has happened, that's happened, which means this is happening. And frankly, our fuel costs are going to go through the roof, and we need to move your wine, and we need still to be here a year from now. If we don't put our prices up, you're not going to have us here in a year's time. Suddenly, everyone's on board.
Yeah, interesting. So if you talk to Lara Catena, who's a winemaker in Argentina, where they've had crippling levels of inflation, she said what they learned in an inflationary environment is you just have to put your prices up. Yeah. Don't try and swallow the pain. Just go, you know what, we have to put our prices up. All right, so we're getting slightly off topic.
Sorry.
This is me getting interested, particularly about how consultants like myself can put prices up. All right, so... You're talking about integrating data and automations, and this is a really big deal in DTC at the moment, where people have got legacy systems and they don't know how to upgrade them and they don't know whether they'll have to start from scratch and so on. What advice have you got to people in this situation who've got old legacy systems that need to upgrade? What should they do?
Gotcha. So, I mean, obviously the very self-biased thing would be to come and have a chat with us at BevSuite, see if we can help, because we are a very, very talented team. We are very flexible in the things we're doing to build our capital, to build our long-term goal. But ultimately, the importance of integration of data, I mentioned the example of the wrong address being on my, on my consignment of wine. But the simple fact is that the customer experience will be affected significantly by integration or not. So the smooth flow of the information from winery to customer, or the smooth, therefore mirrors the smooth flow of product. So there could be government intervention which regulates this and means that this stuff can't happen until you've got some kind of auditable integrated trail. I don't know. I mean, that's not something I know about yet. But there are all kinds of ways that disruption could be caused by not having your system integrated.
Okay, we've skipped a step. So you were at LiveX and then you jumped ship to start your own thing, which is BevSuite. What was the impetus for that, and what are the business problems you're trying to solve with BevSuite?
So the jumping ship thing really is a very selfish one. There are multiple personal reasons why I want to relocate, and LiveX is very much a London. The L in LiveX stands for London, and that's just, you know, the nature of life. But also because I've been there, 6.5, almost 7 years, and I've done two very significant roles doing two quite different things. And I just like new challenges. And LiveX is a very well-established business, very well-respected. It's in a very comfortable, well-carved niche. And I just wanted to do something new and different. I think I said to you before, I wanted to do something slightly terrifying. So I did. And I decided to take the summer off and really test what it was that I was itching to do, where my brain went. I wanted to monitor, you know, what it was that I saw around me that I wanted to do for the next 20 years. And Paul, the founder and CEO of BevSuite, I'd met him via...
his last name?
Kavanagh.
Kavanagh. Okay.
Sorry, Paul Kavanagh. So we'd met doing a project for a customer who is now a customer of LiveX and BevSuite. And we sort of just got on very well and we talked the future, and he described what he was doing. And I kind of went, he's almost ruined my summer because it's too good to turn down. So within about 2 months, I just said yes to Paul and joined the team.
So give me the BevSuite pitch in a nutshell.
So long term, the plan is to build a set of interconnected products and services that make beverage retail and distribution to a certain extent easier, cheaper. We had a sales meeting just yesterday as a team, and we were talking about exactly what you just asked me. What is the business problem that you're really trying to solve? And I think there's a current problem, which is that we've moved through this time where you may remember back sort of the phrase about 10 years ago, which was very acceptable, which was there's an app for that, right? Mm-hmm. Fragmentation of services, fragmentation of everything, really, even in the whiskey trade. Everything was sort of falling into little profitable pieces because somebody could charge for the single thing they did, whether it was a single vineyard wine or a limited release whiskey or an app that did one thing. So what we've ended up with 10 years, 15 years later is business owners in the beverage alcohol industry who now have to deal with 10 different applications where they used to kind of deal with one. They're probably doing more business, maybe, but actually they now have to remember 10 login details. They're getting 100 phone calls from salespeople or customer success people rather than one or 10. You know, it's astronomically bigger than it used to be. So the goal is really just to try and create one single entity that does most of these things. You're never going to do all of it. But actually, importantly, get the data flowing from each segment, each component of that system in a clear, comprehensive and with integrity, so that you haven't got systems kind of talking a different language.
Okay. So what are the services you offer right now?
So there are some that are very, very visible on the website, and we'll talk about those first. Those are email marketing. So basically what we call it concierge inside because it feels very, very apt. It's a very American name. We don't use it much in the UK, but the idea is really that it's a white glove service where one of our staff will look at your, as a retailer, will look at your list of wines that you've got available to you. We'll spot attractive offers from that list, whether that's based on seasonal changes or current trending topics on social media, or whether it's that your price just happens to be good, or whether it's Christmas, all those kinds of things. And they'll decide based on very human factors mixed with some clever tech helping them do it more quickly. And then this is where the true, I guess, the differentiator creeps in, which is that we've got skilled writers, MW students, WSET diploma holders, loads of people from the trade who've also worked in tech. And that's that particular combination that allows us to write those emails in a very convincing, compelling, and different way. So when a customer sees this email, they're not seeing this kind of cookie cutter, generic stamped email that's come from clearly the same output that has driven 100,000 other emails around the country for different retailers. It's truly custom. It looks different. It feels different. It's got a personal sound. And because we know our customers, we can sound like them as well.
Give me an example. So say I'm a wine retailer.
Yeah.
I'm reasonable size, but I'm not huge. Yeah. And I come to you and say, look, you know, I've been ignoring marketing properly. Sort me out.
Yeah.
Tell me the steps and how it works.
So that one's very, very easy, really. We would simply sit down with the customer and say, what is it you're trying to achieve? Like, what is your current state of your data? Or who is your supplier of wine? How big is your list? What, you know, who are your customers? Get all those ingredients together and then say, okay, well, how often do you want these emails to go out? How confident do you feel now? And then we'll put a ridiculously low price. It's extremely attractive at the moment, what the pricing is, for various reasons. And then we'll sit down, write an email for them. If they like it, they like it. If they don't, they don't. And we iterate it from there. And we will use their existing email base, their existing customer base, and their existing list of wines, and generate something beautiful that hopefully drives sales up. And the stats we've got are so far proving very, very positive.
I guess, though, you know, when you haven't done anything or you've done it badly, the first few times that you do it properly, you're going to get a massive ROI. Yes. Compared to what you were doing before, and then it all smooths out. Absolutely. What sort of growth do you think is pent up in the system just because people haven't done things properly?
That's a good question. So at the moment, what we're really focusing on is the impact we can make on an individual level. And because we're not planning to scale this particular service to a very large degree, because we're going to convert it into the bigger service that I was just talking about, we haven't specifically looked at growth of that one service into the next 5-10 years. We're just basically making sure it works now. I think logically, it just makes perfect sense that if everybody wrote really, really good emails, then you lose the competitive advantage because your old competitors are also doing that. So there is a limit to that market, of course. But I just think that the difference we're making is finding or creating the new opportunities that just haven't been taken yet. I realize that's not a beautiful answer for you in terms of numbers and percentages, but...
Let me ask you a couple other questions. Why aren't more people doing email marketing? I mean, it's still an extremely effective channel.
Yeah, I think this is a very personal view on it, but I think we all see so much email in our lives that it's just become too old, too familiar. Familiarity and contempt and all that. And also, we've all seen so much spam across through our inboxes that we've kind of come to see it as a very much second-class post. It's also not as glitzy and glam and flexible as, say, social media. Social media can very much engage with video, and it's very much more real-time. So I think social media remains a very sexy way to advertise. And email doesn't really do that. It's very much...
Okay, so now you're talking down your product. So in that case, let me rephrase the question. Why would you bother doing email marketing, given all the things you've just said?
I would say that it's almost like a Trojan horse into a person's life, because what you're not doing is broadcasting the same, exactly the same message to the entire planet. What you're doing is actually custom crafting an email to an individual who you probably kind of know because they're close to your business. You may have some data on them, and you can actually make a difference in an asynchronous way directly in front of their eyes, and it's to them, it's their inbox. And I just feel like that's actually a well-crafted email gets a lot more personal feeling than a very, very wide broadcast social message.
Yeah, one of the things I often recommend to sort of higher-end clients is that they go back to old-fashioned direct marketing and actually send a letter on quality letterhead, because nobody sends letters anymore, and there's still something about the tactile effect of having a hand-signed letter in front of you, which is really impressive.
Yeah.
And yet people think because it's old-fashioned that it it doesn't work anymore. And yet all the research shows it kicks ass, you know, because people aren't using it any longer.
And I completely agree. I think that's probably what I was just stopped short of saying really about email, is that although, of course, you can send out a very, very large email shot to many, many tens of thousands of people, actually it feels more personalized. Social doesn't really. And because it's a one-to-many broadcast, whereas email feels like it isn't, and a letter really doesn't feel like it isn't. I remember we were recruiting for somebody for my team at LiveX, and a guy walked in physically with a letter. And even though he actually didn't have the right skills that we needed at the time, I did him the honor at least of calling him and talking through stuff and just giving him some time, because he'd earned it. He bothered. Yeah. And I think the personal feeling of that really made an impact. So he'd marketed himself brilliantly to me, and he got something in return.
So I'm quite au fait with email, because I've got an email newsletter through Substack. And I can see pretty quickly at how much cut through you can get. But I also know that it's a very labor intensive thing to do. It takes me ages to write my newsletter. So how on earth can you make money with a team of people writing all of these carefully crafted emails?
So a mixture of reasons, really. One is that the team of people can be more effective because we're using technologies involving AI, but just being efficient at how we do it. And also, I guess the half the work's already done for us. If you think about the legacy or the existing, what would you call it, kind of a head of steam of potential built up by all the marketing that's already been done by the wine company itself. It's created a beautiful label. So you include that if that's appropriate. Or there's a photo of the wine region. That's already been kind of beautified by Mother Nature building a beautiful wine region. And then, of course, there's tasting notes, which you might include from, the famous wine critics. So it's more a matter of, I guess, crocheting, patchworking, creating these things together rather than completely starting from scratch. And it's just working out how to build that combination of interesting stuff, visual, factual, and put that together.
It's still quite labor intensive doing it properly. Are you all being paid high salaries, or are you working on equity?
We are not. A lot of us are really very, very future focused. So the difference about the team is that you've got a bunch of people who kind of idealists, but also know that this is a long haul thing. And we all know that we're putting the work in to really build this big future thing. So although we're aware scalability is not necessarily inherent the way we currently work, every day, every week.
Because a day will come when you start paying salaries, when you're going to have to put your price of your services up.
Yeah.
Have you thought about how you'll manage that?
Yeah. So that'll be a mixture of things, really. So venture capital, of course, will become a big word in our future. We're going to need to make sure that the business stabilizes with VC. And the way you do that is obviously by proving that you've got a solid plan, you've got a solid team, you've got solid products already that will pay back to a certain extent. And there's that sort of flip point, I guess, where your current services, even though they may not be scalable in their current form, will trigger that change. So all of a sudden, you've got VC flowing in because the investors see you can build a decent business, even if it isn't scalable in its current form.
All right, so you're still working with an amorphous, we'll see where this goes. But you've got the email thing happening at the moment. What's your next step? So if you look ahead in 10 years, what do you think you'll be building that the wine trade really needs, or the alcohol trade?
10 years. I'd like to think that we've built to the whole BEV suite as I see it today, which is about 7 components. I'd like to think
talk me through the components. Go from 1 to 7.
This makes me kind of happy, because I actually spent quite a lot of time at the beginning of my time with the business putting together a little a presentation of how I pictured it. So if you think about the way that a retailer's life works, we also work with distributors, but it's easier for me to think about retailers. That's my strong suit. You think about what do you need to do as a retailer? You need to to make sure that your stock is interesting enough for your consumers, for your customers to buy. So you need to source it. Well, how do you decide what to source? You have to just make that decision. So you have to work out what's hot right now, what's got good scores, what's selling cheap, and actually make your decision based on data if you're going to be efficient and accurate about it. Otherwise, you're just buying the same old stuff over and over again, and you don't grow as a business. So you need help sourcing it. Then when the stock lands in your business, you need to make sure that you've actually been delivered what you ordered in the first place. And if something has arrived that you didn't want, you need an efficient way to register that, send it back, get that logged without going through stacks of paperwork. So that's the first two. You've got source and receive. And then, of course, once your stock's in your physical control, you need to manage it. And, you know, you can't run a digital business completely off physical stock. A stock needs to sit somewhere, but you need to register that it exists in your life and you can sell it. So you need a kind of ERP, and then you need a marketing system to actually get that stock promoted on your website, and then you need to sell it. So you need the website to actually do the EPOS, you know, it needs to take the transaction. And then, of course, when someone clicks to buy, you need to ship that stock physically, just flipping back from the digital to the physical again. That stock then has to be correctly sent out to the consumer. So it's kind of six main stages there, with a potential seventh if you add on tracking and monitoring. So here's your answer to your question. So 10 years from now, I'd like to think that we've built those six elements and that we are getting really, really good at tracking the seventh element, which is selling customers more, actually customer analytics. Who's been buying what, why, and what will they buy next?
Oh, okay. So do you see a day that comes when you'll have all of that back-end data and that you'll actually sell data to the wider market?
And that's been exactly what's happened. If you think about the three really now companies that I've worked for, that's exactly the way they've done it. LiveX began with telephones and a spreadsheet, and they were just helping people trade wines. And then suddenly they had data because they had all the knowledge of how much each wine had traded for. WineSearch was the same. It was basically just a kind of an advertising platform for people trying to sell wines. But then, of course, over time, it had a history of how much those wines are being sold for. So those two businesses became very successful data businesses that began operationally. There's absolutely no reason why BevSuite won't be the same.
Okay, so having worked in, you know, such fantastic businesses and seeing so much of the wine trade, we're now heading into a world where there have been some, you know, dramatic underlying structural changes, structural decline. What are you seeing businesses doing wrong at the moment? What can they do in the face of some of these headwinds?
Being distracted. I've seen quite a few people recently say this. In fact, your post, what, from a couple of days ago, the do it to Lucy, what was it?
Julia.
Thank you, Julia. That's where Lucy's come from. Do it to Julia. And I think this was my last post. I occasionally post a BevSuite, and it was very much along the lines of everybody just calm down. Like, there's a lot of distraction happening and you can't control these things. You can get as angry as you like about it. You can attack the other guy. You can, you can be NIMBYist NIMBYist about the fact that your particular vertical shouldn't be subject to these things. You know, like wine shouldn't be being villainized in a way that beer isn't. Everyone's being distracted. And I think too much. And if they just calm down, just get back to normal business and just let this kind of gently rumble along. I know I'm not saying put your head in the sand and ignore it, but just don't react so much.
So, but in terms of wine data and wine sales, where do you see the bright spots?
Gotcha. Obviously, the no and low, the zero alcohol market, that will be its own little bubble. I have interesting chats around with various people around me who, some of us think that will just be a brief bubble before everyone goes, oh, hang on, that's just orange juice. Why would you separate it out as a separate category? There are other people that truly identify it as being a separate category, alcohol alternatives. And there are some people who believe that obviously the main alcohol industry will just rebalance and bounce back, and the zero alcohol remain in its current form. So either way, whatever model you believe in, you need to be aware that zero alc, low and no, will be a category you need to be thinking about. And how you handle that data and how you handle that stock and just be aware of it, I think.
So I want to run some ideas past you and see what you think about them. One thing I've heard is that maybe one of the things that damaged the market was too much premiumization, because when you premiumize, mm-hmm. what you get, when everybody does it, what you actually get is inflation.
Yeah.
And that what is required is a bit more attention paid to the sort of low to mid range to make those wines more interesting again. What do you think?
That's an interesting one. Well, premiumization definitely a thing. I'm not sure I've been in the industry quite long enough. I'm not sure 20 years is quite enough.
You're just getting started.
Yeah. I remember the emergence of the phrase icon.
That's right. Became a thing. I remember that too.
Mm. at Erasurus particularly, there were the Vinos Iconos, and then at Penfolds, you know, we had the Icon range. And that was sort of a new thing back in the, I guess, the early 2000s, I think. Mid-2000s, really. And then the realization, you know, and Peter Gago talks a lot about the halo effect and the impact of the top products and that they have cascading down. So I think there's huge value to premiumization, but you need to work out where you're marketing it to and also keep your market real. Keep customers really aware of, and this is going to sound horrible, but of where they truly sit in that ladder. Do they truly want to be spending that much money? Because not everybody's a Burgundy buyer. Not everybody can afford that. It's just not part of your life.
You're talking to somebody who goes to Lidl and buys gin and tonic in a can. So, yes, you're talking to me. I'm not a Burgundy buyer.
Right, I'm not either. And I have some of my very close friends. I sometimes become very self-aware that I'm almost not very Liebecksy in many ways. And I was aware of that while I was there, that I'm not really a huge Burgundy drinker or a big Bordeaux drinker or even a drinker of ancient wines. The stuff I like is a bit more, this could be because I learned my wine. I got my palate in the Southern Hemisphere, and I really just love fresh, juicy. When it comes to Châteauneuf-du-Pape, for example, I love Grenache focus, less than Mourvèdre. And when it comes to any wine style ever you could offer me, I want bright, I want fruit, I want life. And I just, that actually happily means that I kind of like the cheaper wines.
Well, that's handy.
Yeah, it is.
That is the ultimate good taste. If you can match the if you match what you can afford with what you like.
And it does work. And I'm very, you know, I have some wines I'm very, very fond of, and I buy quite a lot. And I suppose
what I'm getting at is you've had an incredible career in the industry. I mean, you've worked for Treasury, as you said, you've worked in the New World. You've seen the back end through Wine Searcher. Yep. Everybody is, you know, worried about profitability at the moment. So top three things that you think people can do to improve their profitability.
Gotcha. Well, obviously efficiency. I mean, that's always going to be what I'm going to say because of where I've come from, but run your business more efficiently. And that may mean a small investment. That may mean you actually have to pull out some old data and actually get some clean data. It may mean you have to integrate with a system that may be terrifying to you, this idea of integrating some technology. It may cost even into the tens of thousands, but actually to save your business and make sure that you're still there in 2 years' time, it's actually really, really worth it. So efficiency is probably one of them. The other is, like I said, not getting distracted by all these scary things, you know, that we're currently very, very, you know, very recently, very currently hearing from a trade perspective. They're scary, and just working out, fine, take them as you know, at face value. If this is going to happen, what do you want to do with your business, and make a calm decision based on that, and just be confident with that decision, I think. Number three, I feel like I've already given three. But,
pull another one out. Go on. Okay. Pull out another piece of advice.
It's got to be the low and no. It's got to be flexibility. So in any time of change, sure, efficiency is going to make it possible for you to weather the storm and still have capital out the other side. But also you've got to be flexible and be prepared that you may need to sacrifice, rather than stocking 8 Penfolds wines, I'm sorry to pick on Penfolds, sorry, Peter, you may need to stock only 4 or 6, and you just add that little bit of space for the low and no, and just be prepared to talk about it and just be aware that the world is shifting and keep that open mind.
Let me ask you a different question. How bad is the situation with data? Like, I know where I live in Europe, there's lots and lots of businesses that I would expect they're still working on pen and paper and would probably have to start from scratch. So from your point of view, you know, the UK is a much more sophisticated market than in Europe. How behind is the wine trade?
Oh, goodness, that is $1 million question. Well, it's a billion, really. So I can only really give this answer based on what I've been hearing consistently for the last 20 years. And what I see, and I get this from Paul Kavanagh every day. He came from SAP. He spent 17 years there and rose to a very senior position looking at tech, looking at processes, looking at FMCG businesses and how they work. And then he went to visit or work with one of the world's, you know, well, one of America's sort of top wine companies. And I guess that's the difference between those two was so surprising to him that he really, really just got a shock that even the top wine companies do still do stuff on paper. And do you know what? That's part of the charm as well. We shouldn't ever lose faith, sight of that. That part of what makes the wine trade so different and so interesting and partially romantic is that actually it is a little bit old, antiquated. And I guess people kind of like that feeling.
And you're going to storm in and ruin it all with your software and your data and whatever.
I'd like to think that what we'll do, and this is kind of one of our main sort of messages, I guess, is that if you're a business who's looking to make more money so that you can literally, at the moment, it feels like businesses are saying that just so they can be here in 2 years' time, they will need to make more sales. They need more customers. So our response to that is, sure, okay, fine. Who's your best salesman? And the answer, of course, is me. I'm the business owner of a retail business. I'm the one who's going to go and make that customer base. I'm the one who's going to go sell the wine. And you say, okay, what are you doing with your day? And they're going, well, I'm writing emails and I'm filling in forms and I'm taking sales calls. And you're not selling wine then? No, I'm not. And you solve the whole problem for them by making it more efficient. And then they kind of get back to doing the romantic thing that we all love. And
okay, so we hear a lot now about AI. How do you think AI is going to affect the wine business and in what way?
That is a huge question, obviously. I mean, efficiency will dramatically change because of AI, because the speed at which stuff can be analysed, the speed at which data can be distributed, and also the ways we haven't yet begun to think in the wine trade, because we are, there are exceptions, but generally as a trade, we are very old school. And we just haven't begun to think about how AI can really impact us. So I would say that eventually we'll get to a point where the kinds of operations that are being run, even by the kind of thing we're doing, could be done actually by AI. It would never have that glistening, special, human, very wine-specific turn that a human can add to it. But ultimately, AI could just begin writing these emails and firing them out.
Please don't say that. No.
That will go through circles. I confidently believe that you can never truly take away the magic of what it is that wine has built. And it will go through cycles. People will get bored and they'll find ways of detecting what's real and what isn't. And you see authenticity being a key theme across multiple sectors of our industry, wine scoring, wine critique, wine writing being one of them. There are lots of wine groups of authors and critics who call themselves the genuine or the real, and they're trying to really remind people that they are humans. And that actually goes quite a long way, I think. And you see it in, the Shire horses in the vineyard of Burgundy, and there's always this kind of draw to authenticity. And
I guess we're talking now about generative AI, which is, creating text and pictures and stuff, but other AI, do you think that will have an impact on the wine trade?
Goodness, I do wonder whether AI will eventually begin designing wines as well.
That's already happening. Not in the way people think it is, but it is, the chemical analysis of wine being done by AI is quite sophisticated.
Yeah, and you just flip that on its head, and you sort of send that data upstream rather than downstream, and all of a sudden you've got an AI winemaker who is basically making it, to the recipe designed by the AI.
Well, it's interesting when I talk to companies like Tastry, they say it's not that AI is taking over; it's that AI is determining the path to do what the winemaker wants to do.
So it's supporting and making more efficient rather than replacing. Yeah.
No, so it's and the other thing that you can do with it is you can make a justification to management for why you should do it the way that, to do it in a creative way that maybe management hasn't seen before. So, slightly getting off topic, but do you only work in the UK, or are you going to offer BevSuite to places internationally?
Well, oddly, it's actually almost the reverse question. I am the exception because I'm the only member of staff in the UK. Paul is over in San Francisco.
Okay.
Alvin, who's one of our most talented writers, he is in Nashville. We have Corey, who's in the northeast of the States. So actually, the States is our really BevSuite's home. Because of the LiveX connection and London, we have a kind of a London mini operation, and we're currently helping a couple of UK wine businesses to do their thing. And yes, the answer is both sides of the Atlantic, and even Singapore, Hong Kong, there are customers
so interested in Italy. I guess the takeaway from this conversation is that people should book you while you are all still, working on equity and before you put your prices up.
I would.
Is that correct? Have I got
yes,
that right?
Yes, no, completely right. I mean, I'm probably, asking for trouble, but yeah, I mean, the more people that actually come and take advantage of the very low pricing should do. And, it's slightly at odds with what I did at LiveX, because my whole job there was actually working out how much we could charge legitimately. And I know full well that we are not charging that much right now for BevSuite because of where we are in the life cycle. And that's just normal. That's every business has that, where it goes through that really attractive.
So listeners, how do the many listeners of Drinks Insider contact you, Jonathan?
Well, a good way to just go to our website, it's bevsuite.com. It's that easy, and then have a quick look around, and there's a contact form there, and that will go through to one of us. It's a small team, and you'll hear from someone quite quickly, I'm sure.
All right. Well, on that note, Jonathan Reeve, thank you very much.
And thank you. Good to see you.
You've been listening to Drinks Insider, the podcast that explores the intersection of beverages and commerce. Now, if you would like a summary of this episode, sign up for the Drinks Insider newsletter, which sends you the takeaways. Just go to drinksinsider.com and add your name. And if there's something you think we should be talking about, drop me a line at felicity@drinksinsider.com. And before you go, please don't forget to rate this podcast. 5 stars are most welcome. Thank you.